Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Institute for Holocaust Education on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Holocaust survivor Lou Leviticus, a retired professor of agricultural engineering at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, and author of Tales from the Milestone. Dr. Leviticus spoke to the student body at Millard West High School as part of the Days of Remembrance commemoration. Mayor Gene Stothert signed a proclamation declaring the week of April 27, 2014, the Days of Remembrance in Omaha, in memory of the victims of the Holocaust and in honor of the survivors as well as the rescuers and liberators. It further proclaimed that the citizens of Omaha should work to promote human dignity and confront hate wherever and whenever it occurs. Nationally, Days of Remembrance was established by the United States Congress at the same time it authorized the building of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C., as a permanent living memorial to the victims. This program, co-sponsored by the Durham Museum, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday morning, April 30, 2014, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Institute for Holocaust Education, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Mick Hale, Director of Education at the Durham Museum.
Our guest today, Dr. Lou Leviticus, was born in Holland in 1931. After the atrocities of World War II and the Holocaust, he was the sole survivor of his family. Dr. Leviticus moved to Israel in 1951, where he earned a degree in engineering from the Technion. He then traveled to the U.S. and received his Ph.D. in agricultural engineering from Purdue University. Returning to Israel, Dr. Leviticus served in the Israeli army during two wars before immigrating to the U.S. permanently in 1975. He was a professor of agricultural engineering at UNL for over 30 years. Dr. Leviticus is still actively involved with the Larson Tractor Museum and often shares his stories with students and other groups and is the author of Tales from the Milestone. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Lou Leviticus.
Well, thank you for that introduction and thank you for all being here and trying to share a few moments of my life during World War II. I was lucky that I survived. The rest of my family did not. My little girlfriend did not. And I was very much in love with her and was sure that at age 7 we were going to get married. Didn't turn out that way. I've got a story like many others and not like many others because I was never in a concentration camp. I was lucky in that respect. My story really began in 1940. When the Germans invaded the Netherlands in May 10, in fact. And up till then, I'd had my regular school years, went to public school. There was no discrimination, at least that I saw. And we had a lot of different people. We had not only different religions, but we had different colors because the Netherlands had colonies in what is today Indonesia that all belonged to the Netherlands. And in the West Indies, the Antilles and Suriname and Aruba, Curaçao, Bonaire and all those. And so there were a lot of colors, different colors in the classroom. And I never heard or saw, as a kid, any discrimination. I never saw or heard anybody say, dirty Jew, or nigger, or any of those words. which today we feel are unworthy of civilized people. And we didn't have that in school, at least not openly. It was not overt. After the Nazis came to power, it all of a sudden started sprouting up like mushrooms in the fall. All of a sudden there were all kind of little Nazis. And there were all kind of retaliations against what they supposed you were because you had a name. And you wore a star. That was the era when I started, and not only I, but we started feeling fear. Fear permeated the air for us. And those of you, and I'm sure there are some, have felt fear. I'm not going to ask you to stick your hand up, but I'm sure there's quite a lot of you. Fear permeated us because the Germans, the Nazis, among the Dutch, had started acting up against us. We would be beaten in the streets without the police interfering. We would be yelled at. We would be pushed in the gutter. Our backpacks, which we also had in those days. Actually, I remember the lousy backpack I had to carry with the books. The books were taken out and thrown in the mud. Those were the things they did. And they did them without punishment. Police would not interfere. Sometimes there was a righteous person who stopped the abuse, but not always. And I was abused, and friends of mine were abused. One of the friends had his fingers broken. You know what a painful process that is? Poor kid, I don't know what became of him, but I don't think he made it through. Because he was young like I was. And 10-year-old kids, 9-10-year-old kids, were not worth much to the Germans unless they were very big and tall, and so they were gassed and killed, just like the rest of my family, friends, schoolmates. Can you imagine what it is? Not to have a reunion of your classes from school. There's no reunion. There was none for us when we came out of the war. And all of us had certain traumas to deal with. And they say that our whole generation has PTSD. Luckily, I think with me, it's not so evident, but I'm sure that some psychiatrist or psychologist would probably find some traces. Well, what happened? I think most of you have read Anne Frank and have read books by Elie Wiesel, Night, and have books read by other writers about the Holocaust, who wrote about Theresienstadt and other camps. And I lived that life until my dad was picked up in one of the raids which the Germans regularly held, with the help of the Dutch police. They just took Jewish people from the street, sent them straight to a transit camp in the Netherlands, and from there in cattle cars to the concentration camps. If you were lucky and healthy, you could escape the gas chamber. If not, you went straight in and never got out alive, because they were efficient. They had a system well developed. Well, my dad was picked up. Because he'd been laid off from a job which all of a sudden didn't exist anymore. He was a CPA at a big company and did also private work, amongst others, for the Frank family, for Otto Frank, Anne's father. And by the way, in my school was Anne's sister, Margot. So I knew the family pretty well. Knew most of them, anyway, pretty well. With with Anne's mother, I couldn't converse because that lady only spoke German. And I didn't speak German. I understood it. But that's the way it was. So he was sent to a work camp, my dad, which wasn't too bad. They made him work regularly in this case it was in the forests, planting trees, uprooting trees, Lord knows what. And then one day he decided to escape. Before they would transport the whole camp, according to rumor, to Germany. And he did not want to go there. That was death. We knew that by then. In the beginning, actually, nobody believed that the Germans would do what they did in the Netherlands, that the Germans could do what they did in Germany and in Poland and in Hungary and in Czechoslovakia and in Belgium and in France and in Denmark and in Sweden. Oh no, not in Sweden, sorry, Norway, the neighbor. So he didn't want to go. But by escaping, he became not only a dirty Jew, which could be killed or murdered, but he also became a criminal. And by association, my mom and I became criminals too. Here I was, a criminal of 11 years. So I had to go, and my mom had to go, and my dad had to go into hiding. You think that was easy? But just think about, where do you find a place? How do you find a place? Do you have addresses? Can you go to people you know and ask them to put their life on the line by hiding Jews? And Jews who had escaped were enemies of the Third Reich. So it wasn't easy to find a place. And then what do you do for food? It was war. It was already 1942 in the beginning for us. And there is no food in the war. during a war, not enough anyway. And all the good food from the Netherlands is exported to the German armies, which are fighting in the east. And a little bit in France against the Maquis, their underground, their resistance. So you need money to buy food. Where do you buy food? Not in a store, regularly, only on the black market. So that's twice, three times as expensive. What happens when you get sick? Where do you find a doctor who can be trusted? Where do you find the medicines? From a pharmacy which can be trusted. And maybe they don't have those medicines anymore. So life became a very difficult situation for people to go into hiding. And they had to have money. And without money, you couldn't go into hiding. Well, you could go, but you could not sustain yourself very long. And everybody thought and hoped that the war would end soon. Well, it didn't turn out that way. Here it was beginning of 1942, and Hitler was still sitting pretty and making gains in Europe and in the East. So we all went into hiding and we all became criminals. Now the first place we went to was a farm, and I loved the farm. I loved the farm work, and I liked to work because I had to somehow expend my energy. And I'd been a soccer player, and I know we don't play soccer in this country. It's not done, except the girls, and they do a good job, by the way. But in Holland, girls didn't play soccer. It was a man's game. And hockey. And there was a sort of basketball, which, by the way, was played with a real basket, a woven basket, and you had to be awfully tall to even get close to the darn thing. And I was a little snurt, and there was just nothing that I could do to play that game. And I don't think I ever got a ball into that basket in my whole life. Anyway, we were at the farm. I liked the work. I liked the milking. I liked the haying. I liked the feeding, the slopping of the pigs. I didn't care a hoot what I did. My mother did, because she didn't like me smelling like, well, you know what it smells in a pork stall, in a sty. And I smelled like a sty, usually. I never managed to keep myself clean, and I still today don't. Ask my wife. And so I liked the work. I loved to be there. There was one problem. And that was that the two daughters, which are about 6-7 years older than I was, used me as their plaything, and I was constantly sexually abused by those two girls. So that was, and I had to keep my mouth shut. If I didn't keep my mouth shut, they were going to go to the police, they said. And that would have brought my mom and dad to a concentration camp, me too. And I didn't want to die, and I didn't want them to die. What do you think? So I kept my mouth shut. It took a couple of weeks. I don't really know for sure how long, because I didn't have a calendar. But I learned to live with it. It was just part of my life, regularly, every night that I can remember. Well, then one day we had to up and leave. Why? I don't know. My dad never told me. My mom never told me. Parents didn't talk to children about those problems. If it hadn't been for my German girlfriend, which I had, I was never without one. I would never have known what went on in Germany and why they left. So, my parents didn't tell me why we moved or had to move, but we moved to a city where we had a room and a sort of patio, of a porch on the third floor of a building of a large apartment house, an old apartment house. They were old. They didn't have bathtubs. You took a bath in one of those small galvanized oval things, and the clothes were washed in that oval thing, and everything was done in that little tub. And the reason I speak about the tub, I'll come to later. So we moved, we had to move. We have that apartment, and now we have neighbors on all sides, and we have to be quiet all day and all night, 7-12, 12-7, day after day. And you know how difficult that is? You can't jump on the bed, you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't shout, you can't laugh out loud, you can't sing, you can't make noises, because the neighbors are going to ask questions, and you don't know who those neighbors are. And neighbors talk amongst each other, and invariably it will get to the wrong ears, which is why so many of those people in hiding were caught. If you remember, maybe from the book, Anne Frank and her family, a total of four, were with four other people in the hiding place in Amsterdam. Somebody tatted, and somebody betrayed, and somebody made a lot of money, which they got from the Germans. For every soul which was betrayed, money was paid, or some position, some kind of a favor was given by the Germans. So I wasn't going to blab when I was on the farm, and I kept quiet 24/7 when I was in the apartment. What did we do? Well, we played cards, but not with a lot of noise. We played chess, checkers, games like Parcheesi or similar games, not with those names, but the same name, Monopoly, was a favorite game, and things like that. And you read books. I read more books than I can ever think about to do today. And quite often these were grown-up books where there was more than just little adventures, because there were also relationships of different sorts between the male and the female sex. And I didn't understand everything, even though I'd learned a lot from those two girls on the farm. So I had to ask my dad, because my mom just couldn't answer those questions. She was incapable of doing that. So I had to ask my dad, and he would explain in a few words what was going on there between those two in the book. Well, we didn't keep a calendar, so I don't know. I didn't know what the time, what the date was in general. But I know that on November 2nd, 1942, the street bell rang in the apartment below us. That was the apartment to which the room we had rented belonged. And that lady used to bring us food once a day, which my mother divided up into three portions, morning, midday, and evening. And the slop bucket, because we couldn't use the regular water closet, which did work, but which made noise. So we were not allowed to use that, because it would, again, there would be questions. So the bell rang. The lady downstairs pushed the button, which opened the electric door, and steps came running up the stairs, and the voices shouted, "Police! Stay where you are!" I froze. I knew what had happened. They were here to come and get us. So I stood there like the stone pillar Lot, when he was, or rather Lot's wife, when they were caught, when they fled from the Sodom and Gomorrah punishment. I froze. I just couldn't move. It was like in a nightmare. And I don't know how many of you ever had a nightmare that you couldn't get out of. I mean, you stood there, you couldn't move. Something threatened you. And that threat was the problem. Those were the Germans and the Nazis storming up the stairs. And then my dad, bless him, said a few words which I was never allowed to utter. And he certainly never uttered them in the house or anywhere near. And that shook me. That shocked me that he would say things like that. And all of a sudden, I knew what I was going to do. I ran to the back doors of the room. I opened those doors, pushed them open, jumped on the porch and climbed the fence which separated the porch from the rest of the open air. And I sat there for maybe a tenth of a second, and I looked over my right shoulder and I saw my dad grab those doors close and behind me, wave me, and said, "Go, go." I saw his mouth. And in the meantime, he also shut off the crying of my mother, who was crying in the room. I jumped. On the ground floor, the first floor, there was still an awning, one of those nice rounded ones. I jumped, I hit it at the right angle, pure luck or not, I don't know. I slid down, it broke my fall. I slid down and landed on my feet in front of a German soldier. He had been posted there to catch escapees. Now, I was surprised, and I think he may have been surprised also, because he didn't do anything to stop me. He could have shot me, because he had one of those little submachine guns. He could have made a sieve out of me with that thing. But he didn't do anything, and I ran. I ran away. It had been raining, which it always is in October, November in the Netherlands. One of those drizzles, cold and miserable. But I ran. I ran to the end of the garden, climbed the fence. I couldn't jump it. It was too high. Climbed the fence, climbed over that fence, ran through the next garden, climbed over the next fence, ran to the next garden, through the next garden, until I was totally out of breath. And I must have been quick, because I was crying at the same time. I was in shock. I hyperventilated. Everything but that could be wrong with me was wrong with me. And I was afraid that they would come out on the porch and shoot me in the back. That was the terrible fear that I had, beside the other fears. And I looked around, where shall I hide? And I climbed up on a rain spout. I was a good climber. I was a good athlete, actually, in the sports I participated. And I climbed up, got myself on the porch on the second floor, and sat down underneath one of those little tubs, which everybody had, because nobody had a bathtub. Those houses were not equipped with bathtubs. They had a toilet, and they had two sinks, one in the toilet washroom, and one in the kitchen. That was it. So I sat down and relaxed. Now, when your body relaxes, really relaxes, after an effort, nature usually throws you a curve. You have to go. Because I hadn't gone before, I fled. So I had to go, and I had to do a big one. And I wasn't going to poop in my pants for anything. Clean Dutch kids didn't do that. And I'm sure clean American kids don't do it either. And I'm an American kid now. Old kid, but a kid. So now I had to find something. So I got out from under that tub very carefully. And I found some jute cloth bags, paper bag, tore the paper off. And that's not charming, I can tell you. I got the paper and I found a flower pot. I scooted over under the tub, did what I had to do, cleaned myself as well as I could, and put the flower pot over the whole shebang. Oh. And then I found out I couldn't sit there without getting a cramp with that darn flower pot. So I had to get out from under that. And you know, I'm still wondering what the lady of the house thought a couple of days later when she wanted to use that tub for the laundry or to wash her feet in. I never was able to go back and explain my misdeed because the apartment building was totally demolished during bombardments. And I didn't know the name of the people. So anyway, I was out. I sat down in a coal bin until it was totally dark. Now, in October, in Netherlands, it starts already darkening at about 3:30, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So by the time I was ready to do something, it was pitch dark. And it was a blackout, so there were no lights in the streets. There were no lights coming from windows or doors, because people would receive severe fines if there was light coming out, visible light to the streets. So it was very dark, pitch dark. And here I was actually in a strange city. The only place I knew there was the house of the person who had helped us get the illegal addresses and the ration cards and so forth. I knew where he lived. They had a big dairy store. But like I said, it was pitch dark. How do you get from one end of a city you don't know to the other one without walking into a canal? Well, you hold on to the houses and you try to see by the little moonlight which comes through the clouds in the wintertime. From time to time, you can see the house and the houses. So I made my way. Took me a long time. I knocked on their window, the window of the store, at 9 o'clock in the evening, approximately. So I'd been on my own from 3 o'clock till 9 o'clock. 6 hours in the rain. My house shoes had long dissolved into nothingness, and my socks I didn't wear because I'd been in the house. And why wear the socks in the house? and house shoes when you don't have to wash them later. So I didn't wear socks. So I was barefoot. It's a miracle I didn't step in glass or nails or whatever other things. So they let me in, but only temporarily, because the man of the house, the guy who had helped us, had also been betrayed together with a group of about 30 people. And my parents and I were among those. Now, since he had been betrayed, he had to flee also. And the Germans would surely be coming back to look for him. They also came back, apparently, to look for me, but they could never find me. Well, anyway, I got some clothes, I got some food, I even got a knife to cut things with. And I started moving in the middle of the night. It was probably 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, still pitch dark. I started moving east. How did they know it was east? Well, the winds came out of the west, always at that time of the year. There was a little moon over the clouds, so you could see that moon spot in the clouds, which weren't too thick, and you could see those clouds moving in that direction. So that was east. I wanted to move east because that's where forests were. And forests was safety. I knew that. You could always hide there. And there were always little farms and farmhouses and chicken coops and all sorts of small buildings you could hide. We are not sure how long I lived in those various areas. I did not move in the middle of the day, because to see a little figure, a little kid, walking or running through the fields in the middle of the day would be suspicious, to say the least. And they would call the police, and who was I? I didn't have an identity. If I told them my real name, they only have to call up the main office of the Gestapo, and they know exactly who I am. Invent a name. What name shall I invent? Jake Peterson from Ogallala? Well, they look, Jake Peterson, Ogallala, there isn't any. So what must I be? I must be a Jew, because I was circumcised. And in those days, most kids were not. I know things have changed in the world, but a lot of people were taken off the street when there was one of those raids by just pulling their pants down and having a look if they were circumcised. If they were, they were Jews, and they were transported to the concentration camps and the gas chambers. Well, I bummed around quite a bit. I don't know how long it was, but there was stuff to eat. You could milk a cow in the middle of the night, even though they didn't like it. And there were still very late sour apples on the trees. There were carrots in the ground, big carrots. You don't, it's sort of a mangle. They get to be about this big. And the inner part is delicious and very nourishing. And you could steal food because the farmer and his wife were usually out of the house. The house was open and you could get in, steal what they called speck from the, that's the outer layer of fat on the pig's bag, back with the skin, which was hanging in the smokehouse. And you take a nice slab of that, stick it in your pocket, hands dirty or not, didn't bother. You had something to eat. There was bread, you took bread. If there was butter, you put butter on it. If you could find cheese, you took a slab of cheese. Cookies was heaven, and so on. So I managed. I don't know how long. We tried to make a calculation later. I must have been about 2 to 3 weeks that I was on my own until I was caught by a farmer. And he was a good guy, turns out. I gave him the name of a person I knew who might not have been caught by the Gestapo, and asked him to contact him, and he would know what to do with me. Lo and behold, in the meantime, I did the work on the farm. Hey, by now, I was 11 years old, I had good muscles, and I knew the work. And he trusted me. His family also helped. There was a boy and a girl there, which were older than I was, so they could do a lot of the work too. And after a while, he found people from the resistance. They came to get me, and I stayed with them for quite a while, until a year after the war ended, on the 8th of May, 1945. And after I got out from their protection, from their home, I went to an orphanage and started a new life. And I'll stop right here, and I'll want to see those hands go up and questions. And I'm not bashful, as you can well, as you may have figured, so you can really ask me very personal questions, if you wish, if you have them.
What were some of the thoughts you had when you were hiding by yourself?
Well, you know, that's a tough one, a tough question. I'd hate for you to be my examiner on an exam. But, you know, you think about everything. Because when you're really on your own, alone, what are you going to do? What are you going to be? Where are you going to go? Whom can you count on? If the war was over, what are you going to do? Well, I was staying with these people from the resistance, and I got really attached to them. And I wanted to stay there and go to school. I was starting to go high school and so on. in an adjacent city. And that was, by the way, that was a 5-mile walk to the school and back every day. It wasn't so easy, but it kept me healthy. And I was willing for that to go on. I had no plans beyond that. What was I going to do? Was I going to go to a university? I didn't have the money. I'd have to take a job. But I got out of high school early because I did the 5-year high school, which we had in the Netherlands, in 3 years. So here I had 2 years in which I had to find a job, which you couldn't in the Netherlands at that time. A kid couldn't find a job like to make money for the university. So I was sort of stuck. I was going to go out of the country. I found a job with a band. I taught myself how to play piano, guitar, and so on, a bunch of instruments during the war. So I went with a band, and we made some money. But our money manager was not the best manager of the money, so we ran out of money in Marseille. And they all had families in the Netherlands. I had nothing. They went back. I stayed in Marseille. I lived sous les toits de Marseille, as they say, under the roof pans of the roofs in Marseille, 3 floors above a whorehouse, which was interesting. You should see those types. And I made some money, and I started traveling. And I worked any job. That's how I made money. And I knew I was going to study and make something of myself. I wanted to be able to look back on a past I could be proud of. Give me strength. Give me something to stand on, even though my legs were okay, but something real to stand on and rely upon. And that's why I started studying and working, ultimately ending up as professor here at the University of Nebraska. That's, in short, long, my story there.
Do you ever wish that you stayed with your family when the police entered the building, when your family were in hiding, or are you content with what you did, like the escape?
No, I'm happy I left, because I found a home, another home, here in Nebraska. And hadn't I left my family, there would be nobody to talk about them. Now just imagine, you have parents, after they pass, which I hope is not soon, but you have grandparents. If nobody ever talks about them, did they really exist? Who knows about them? Who can talk about them? They're non-existent people because there's no memory of them. And I want my parents to live on, which is why I wrote the book about where they appear. Of course, the main person is me, but I write about them. And I talk about them when I talk to you. And you know, if you get older and you happen to have the misfortune, which you all shall have, that your parents pass on, if you don't talk to them, about them, to your grandchildren, nephews, cousins, other family members, they might as well not have existed. Their names in the register, but who knows them? Who knows about them? Who knows about the good things they did or the bad things they did? But it gives them a living personality. And that is why I talk about the Holocaust. Because I want my mom and dad to be remembered. Max and Sarah Leviticus were real people. Innocent people. But they were murdered like another 6 million. Actually, another 9 or 10 million, because the total number of people who were murdered by the Nazi was about 10 million in the gas chambers and the concentration camps. But none of those people had any value if they were not mentioned by name, if they were not remembered on monuments. And by convocations like this one, you now know who Lou Leviticus is. And maybe in another 20 years, you might remember, hey, there was that strange little guy sitting on the stage, jabbering away. But I will be remembered. And I want my parents and the family to be remembered, because by remembering, they stay alive forever.
Ladies and gentlemen, one more time, let's give Lou a hand.
Nice to meet you. Thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you so much. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Institute for Holocaust Education on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Holocaust survivor Lou Leviticus, a retired professor of agricultural engineering at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, and author of Tales from the Milestone. Dr. Leviticus spoke to the student body at Millard West High School as part of the Days of Remembrance commemoration. This program, co-sponsored by the Durham Museum, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday morning, April 30, 2014, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Liz Feldstern, Executive Director of the Institute for Holocaust Education, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 400 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.